On business and labor to order, and I'm going to welcome everyone here today. And I'm going to open the public hearing on House Bill 3339.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 3339 is sponsored by Representative Witt. It modifies conditions under which an individual may be eligible for unemployment insurance benefits when they become unemployed due to a lockout resulting from a labor dispute. There is no revenue impact on the measure. There is a fiscal impact statement in process, but it's not ready for today's hearing.
And that's why we will not be moving this bill today. We're going to hear it today, and it will be back. All right, I'm going to be calling, I believe Representative Witt is here. Come on, Brad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm State Representative Brad Witt from House District 31, appearing here this afternoon in support of House Bill 3339. The bill closes the door on a very cruel, grossly unfair, and I would argue anachronistic economic weapon used by some private sector employer groups to quite literally starve their employees into submission during contract negotiations. And I think it would perhaps better be characterized when this weapon is used during contract warfare. Now, the short version of my testimony, I would say quite simply that if employees are ready, willing, and able to go to work, as the statute currently describes, that when they are denied that opportunity by their employer, despite the circumstances or the context in which that occurs, that they should be entitled to receive unemployment insurance benefits. Now that would conclude my short version. The problem that I have, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, is sometimes this issue gets confused with the context. Context being strikes, lockouts, those sorts of things. And at the risk of adding further confusion myself, I'm going to wade into those weeds and try and explain that context. By way of background, the National Labor Relations Act, as amended, at least in theory, has tried for over some 70 years now to balance the power relationships between unions and companies. Now, tangential to House Bill 3339, the NLRA, National Labor Relations Act, balances a union's right to strike with management's right to lock out their employees and vice versa. Similarly, both sides may also choose, if they so decide, to bargain in a coalition. The NLRA also shoulders a moving party with the consequences of its own economic action. And again, tangentially to this bill, what this means is if a union decides to strike an employer, the union then suffers the consequences of its action, those consequences being that the company has a right, if it so decides, to replace those striking workers, otherwise known as strike breakers. Conversely, if a company locks out its workforce, the lockout effectively terminates that company's ability to operate its facilities. Now, the board that oversees the act has determined that a lockout is a lockout is a lockout. The company doesn't have an opportunity to lock out some of its employees at the exclusion of some and not to lock out others. It has to lock out everyone. Doesn't mean that what it says is the company doesn't get to hire other people. It shuts down its operations, period. That's the consequences that the company suffers. So we have that balance that the NLRA tries to maintain. Now, into this mix, I've been describing federal law. Into this mix, specifically targeted towards this bill, enter state unemployment insurance. How does it try to balance strikes and lockouts? Now, if I strike, or my union strikes, and I'm a union member, I have made myself, or my union has rendered its membership unavailable to work by virtue of striking the employer. We're out of work, but we're unentitled to unemployment insurance benefits. We made the decision. It was our initiative. We have removed ourselves from availability. Now, on the other hand, what if I'm locked out? I am otherwise ready, willing, and able to work, but my employer has denied me the opportunity to do so. Do I qualify for unemployment insurance benefits? And I ask the question rhetorically for you to consider that. Because the way state statute reads right now, it depends. Depends on the circumstances. If my employment relationship, if my negotiations relationship, better stated, with my employer is a single employer relationship, in other words, the union negotiates a contract with a single employer. There are only two parties to this agreement, the union and the employer. If that occurs and the employer locks out, under state law, I can collect unemployment. I'm ready, willing, and able to go to work, but my employer has denied me the opportunity. Under most circumstances, I'm able to collect. Now, this bill addresses multi-employer situation, whereby the union negotiates a contract, the same contract, with several employers in the same industry. Under that scenario, state statute right now precludes the employee, even though, or employees, despite the fact they're ready, willing, and able to go to work, from collecting unemployment insurance. Now, why is that? Theoretically and fairly, I can give you no good reason. Politically, I can give you a reason. Because up to this point, the lobbyists for the other side have just done a better job. And have been able to maintain this power imbalance over far too long of a period of time. And because of this, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, as I stated earlier, I believe this power imbalance is cruel. It's used as an economic weapon, a very, very harsh economic weapon. It is unfair for the reasons that I have tried to underscore here today in my testimony. And as I said at the beginning, I believe it is also anachronistic. It harkens back to a much, much earlier era of unrestricted capitalism. I urge you to put an end to this unbalanced and unfair outcome, and to please act favorably on House Bill 3339. And those employees who are locked out, ready, willing, and able to work, but because of a loophole in our state statute, multi-employer bargaining relationship, are unable to collect unemployment benefits. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Be happy to try and answer any questions that you might have.
I have no questions, Representative. I thank you for bringing this bill. I agree with the bill. When we get a fiscal on it and we... assuming we have the votes on the committee, we'll be voting it out, I hope, and to the floor, and hopefully change this part of the law. Any questions for the good representative?
I assume we're going to have further testimony.
Oh, there's plenty of further testimony,
so.
Representative.
I need
lots
to
of nice people here on both sides of the issue. All right, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Have a good afternoon. All righty then. Let me see. I'd like to call Jeff Smith and Rick Ball, please.
Good
whoever's ready to go first. Ready.
Greetings, Chairman Schaffler and committee members. My name is Jeff Smith. I reside in Portland, Oregon at 5738 North Denver Avenue. I am the president of Local 8 of the International Longshore Warehouse Union, address of 2435 Northwest Front Avenue, again in Portland. I represent the interests of 600 members and affiliates. I am also the president of the District Council of the ILWU, which is the political arm for the ILWU locals in Oregon. In my capacity as the District Council President, I represent an additional 1,000 members working in Coos Bay, Astoria, Newport, and Portland. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today with respect to House Bill 3339. The ILWU fully supports HB 3339 as it serves to bring parity between the treatment of single-employer model workers and multi-employer model workers and the state of Oregon and its two neighboring states, California and Washington. In both neighboring states where multi-employers groups lock out employees as a negotiating tactic, the locked-out employees are eligible for employment benefits based on their past earnings. In Oregon, only where a single employer locks out its employees are those employees eligible for benefits. Employees of multi-employer groups are not eligible by law. The ILWU first learned of this discrepancy in treatment, not just between states, but in Converge within the state of Oregon itself, when the multi-employer group Pacific Maritime Association, representing approximately 70 different companies, locked out 25,000 working longshoremen in the states of California, Oregon, and Washington in the year 2002. The lockout was short-lived after the federal government intervention prohibited the tactic. Longshoremen in the states of Washington and California applied for and received employment benefits. Longshoremen in Oregon applied and were denied employment benefits. Had the Oregon longshoremen not been employed by a multi-employer group, but in a more traditional single-employer model, they would have received employer benefits. This bill rectifies the discrepancy. We urge its passing. Thank you, Committee Chairman Schaffler and committee members.
Thanks, Jeff. Mr. Ball, you want to go ahead?
Yes, my name is Rick Ball. I'm a union representative for United Food and Commercial Workers, Local 555 in Tigard, Oregon. I'm here today in support of House Bill 3339. I'm in the process of negotiating a labor contract for 1,200 grocery workers in the Eugene-Springfield area. The employers involved in these negotiations know that they can lock out workers, thereby forcing them to accept lower wages and worse working conditions. Should the workers wish to fight the employers on the takeaways, these workers could be forced into an economic decline wherein they might lose their homes and be forced into leaving the communities to find work elsewhere. If House Bill 3339 were enacted, these lockout workers would have a better chance at saving their homes, staying in their communities, and an ability to stay at the bargaining table to negotiate a fair settlement in their labor dispute. I urge you to support the passage of House Bill 3339 as it will help level the playing field between Oregon workers and employers. Thank you for your time and interest in this bill.
Thank you.
Chairman, my name is Tom Chamberlain. I'm president of the Oregon AFL-CIO. Chairman Schaffler, members of the committee. The Oregon AFL-CIO supports House Bill 3339. There's not much I can add. I think Representative Witt laid out the issue very well, and my brothers to the right of me as well. But I would add this. We're not talking about making employees whole. We're talking about an unemployment benefit that's a maximum of $445 a month. If employees are locked out, if they get these benefits, they're still going to be suffering an economic hardship, health care, loss of pension benefits. So this is just a means to get them through whatever strife they're under at that time caused by the lockout. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions of the gentleman? All right, thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to go to the other side of the dial here and call some nice people, Gary Oxley, Dan Floyd, Steve Endman, and Melinda Merrill. See what you have to say about this bill.
Welcome.
Good
Gary, if you're ready, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Gary Oxley, Oxley & Associates, appearing before you this afternoon on behalf of Fred Meyer and Safeway. With me are representatives from both companies, Melinda Merrill, who is the government affairs and public relations person for Fred Meyer, and Steve Erdman, who is a labor negotiator for Safeway stores. So, Mr. Chairman, if I may, I would like them to proceed with their testimony.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you for your time today and for the opportunity to testify. I'm Melinda Merrill. I'm the Director of Public Affairs for Fred Meyer Stores, and I'm here today on behalf of Carl Wojciechowski, who is our Group Vice President of Human Resources, and he's unable to be here today. I'm here to testify against HB 3339. Fred Meyer Stores has an 80-year history in Oregon, and we currently provide 13,000 Oregonians with family wage jobs, including health and welfare benefits for our associates and their families. Most of our store employees have been unionized for more than 40 years, and currently more than 70% of our employees in Oregon are unionized. Our unionized employees in Oregon are represented by the United Food and Commercial Workers Local 555. Well, we have had a few labor disputes, as would any unionized company who's had a 40-plus year relationship with a union. Overall, our relationship with our employees' union representatives is strong. We are concerned about HB 3339 because it will create a situation where the state is aiding the unions in a strike. The state will essentially be lending support to unions in a labor dispute. Under HB 3339, the state will be providing unemployment benefits to employees who are unemployed due to an action of their own choice. And it could result in an inequitable situation where some employees who are on strike will not have unemployment, while others who are on strike will and are part of the same strike will have unemployment. In Oregon, the grocery industry enters into multi-employer bargaining agreements with the unions that represent our associates. In fact, as Mr. Ball from the UFCW mentioned, we're in multi-employer bargaining negotiations with UFCW in the Eugene area right now, along with our colleagues at Safeway and Albertsons. The outcome of these negotiations will affect employees throughout Southern and Central Oregon. The National Labor Relations Act allows these multi-employer bargaining agreements, and these bargaining agreements have benefits for employees, for their union, and for employers. The main benefit is that it creates a level playing field where employees across the industry are being paid the same wages and benefits for the same work. It helps ensure that the same conditions apply across the industry. When unions and employers agree to multi-employer bargaining, they sign a multi-employer bargaining agreement prior to the beginning of contract negotiations. Under the NLRA, a multi-employer bargaining agreement provides that a strike against one employer is a strike against all employers in the bargaining unit. So if A, B, and C enter into a multi-employer bargaining agreement with one or more locals, the unions call a strike against employer A, then employers B and C lock out their employees. This is termed a defensive lockout. When the union and its members call a strike against an employer and the other employers in the bargaining unit lock out, employees and their unions agree to this up front. They know that if they strike, it's considered a strike against all under NLRA and currently under Oregon law. Employees also have a second chance to consider this if and when their union asks them to take a strike authorization vote. So employees and unions go into this with their eyes wide open. When employees go on strike, they do not receive unemployment benefits. Conversely, as has been discussed, if an employer not involved in a multi-employer bargaining unit locks out its employees, which is termed an offensive lockout, employees do receive unemployment benefits. And they receive unemployment benefits in this situation because their unemployment is not due to any vote or choice of their own. It was their employer's decision. The law and many states consider defensive lockouts the same as a strike. Oregon has considered defensive lockouts the same as a strike, and as such is not provided for unemployment compensation during the strike. When employees take a strike vote under a multi-employee bargaining agreement, they are aware that if they are locked out, they will not receive unemployment. They go into these agreements with full knowledge of how they work. Defensive lockouts are not perpetrated by the employer. They are perpetrated by the union when it strikes an employer that is part of a multi-employer bargaining agreement. The state does not provide unemployment in a strike, so why would they provide unemployment in a defensive lockout? Doing away with the unemployment exemption in a defensive lockout would, first of all, create a completely inequitable situation. The employees of the struck employer would not receive unemployment from the state, while the employees who are part of the defensive lockout would receive unemployment from the state. So you'd have a group of employees who are on strike due to the same contract negotiations and the same issues, and some of them would be getting unemployment and some of them would not. Doing away with the unemployment exemption in a defensive lockout could also essentially do away with multi-employer bargaining. Why would an employer enter into the agreement when we know that, if there is a strike, the state is going to help take away any incentive for employees and their unions to go back to the bargaining table? And finally, as I've mentioned, doing away with the unemployment exemption would result in the state assisting the unions in a strike by providing unemployment benefits to employees who have chosen to walk off their jobs. I ask you to please reconsider the effect of this bill, especially the effect it would have on a bargaining system that has been in place and worked well for more than 30 years. In the 30 years that Fred Meyer has been participating in multi-employer bargaining agreements with UFCW Local 555, there have been fewer than 6 strikes in Oregon and Southwest Washington. Thank you for your time today.
Sir, go ahead.
Ms. Chairperson, members of the committee, thank you for your time and the opportunity to present testimony today. My name is Steve Erdman, and I'm the Director of Labor Relations for Safeway's Portland Division. I'm here to testify strongly against House Bill 3339. Safeway has a long history in Oregon and is one of the state's largest employers. We have nearly 11,000 Oregonians in retail positions and another 800-plus in our Oregon supply and distribution operations. The vast majority of our employees have been unionized for more than 6 decades, and we have 56 labor agreements covering our Oregon employees. In the 30 years that I have represented Safeway in one position or another, I have been involved in the renegotiation over 570 Safeway contracts. Only 9 times during that 30-year period have those negotiations broken down and involved strikes in Oregon. We've had 6 strikes at retail and 3 in our supply and distribution network. In every one of those 9 strikes, Safeway was negotiating as part of a multi-employer group with other companies with an identical contract and similar interests. In 5 of those strikes, Safeway was the strike target. We were lucky enough to have the pickets, and all of our employees refused to work. And our bargaining partners locked out their employees in response to the union's decision to strike Safeway alone. In the other 4 strikes, Safeway locked out its involved employees when the union chose to strike one of our bargaining partners rather than everybody in the multi-employer group. Why were the employees locked out? Because all involved employees, regardless of which company they were working for, stood to gain because of the settlement ultimately reached by the bargaining parties. They had a vested economic interest in the outcome of the strike. Melinda has addressed the fact that in multi-employer negotiations, the union must agree. And let me emphasize that. The union must agree at the outset of negotiations to the multi-employer arrangement. If the union does not agree to it, the employers are not permitted by federal labor law to bargain as a multi-employer group. When the union agrees to multi-employer bargaining, they know what the ground rules are. They know employees, by their bylaws, are going to have to authorize a strike in a strike vote. They know that the employees will have the right to actually vote on whether or not to go on strike when the employers present an offer. And, as Melinda noted, they know that a strike against one employer is a strike against all in a multi-employer context. Let's be clear about what HB 3339 really does and why it's bad for Oregon. It would eliminate the defensive lockout exclusion under ORS 657-200. While the term lockout sounds ominous, and certainly from witnesses who have testified here already today, they make it sound like a one-sided club, let me explain what it really is, because clearly it's not very clear, and it's pretty simple. There are 2 types of lockouts. What if, in the midst of contract negotiations with a union, a single employer with a single group of employees represented by a single union, make it simple, one of each, the employer decides that he's not going to allow his employees to come to work until the new contract is negotiated, thereby putting economic pressure on the employees who are ready, willing, and able to work. You've already heard Representative Witt and 2 other gentlemen speak to that situation. If the employer locks his employees out when they're ready, willing, and able to work, it is an offensive lockout. That's what it is under federal labor law. And in an offensive lockout situation, employees are eligible for and can receive unemployment benefits from the state of Oregon. In that situation, the employees are ready, willing, and able to work. Their access and ability to work is unrestricted, and the employer is not letting them work in order to put economic pressure on them. That is an offensive lockout. How does that differ from a defensive lockout that Melinda mentioned? Let's take that fact situation and look at it from a slightly different perspective. Let's say our employer has one location, one union contract, and he's negotiating with the union, and the employees go on strike. The employer hasn't chosen to put those employees on strike or cut off their economic well-being by doing an offensive lockout. The employer is willing, ready, and able to continue bargaining, but the union has chosen to strike, and the employees have voted to strike. In that situation, Oregon law says they are not eligible for benefits. They chose to withhold their services. It was their decision, not their employer's, for them to strike. If the state paid unemployment benefits in that circumstance, it would be taking sides in the labor dispute, and by providing a source of alternate income to striking employees would prolong the strike, creating a situation having a negative impact on the state's economy. And that's why, year after year, the state has not agreed to provide unemployment benefits to striking employees. Now, let's change that fact situation just a little bit. Let's say that our single employer with our single workplace, instead of having one plant, has two. And instead of having, for example, 1,000 workers at one plant, he has 2,000 workers, 1,000 at each plant. They're still one group. They're all covered by the same collective bargaining agreement, and they vote to go on strike. But when they go on strike, 1,000 of the employees at plant number one strike and picket and don't come to work. And the other 1,000 employees go to work and say, yeah, we're ready to go. We'll continue working. If the employer says, half of you are already on strike, I can't have the rest of you working and not knowing when you're going to go. I need to protect my assets. I can't operate my business and so forth. And chooses not to have the second group of employees work who are willing to work at the second plant. Under Oregon law, that is not an offensive lockout. Under a provision of 657-200 that the bill does not propose to change, the law says that when an employer has multiple locations that are covered by the same collective bargaining agreement, that they're considered to be one location for the purpose of determining whether there is a strike going on. And under that circumstance, the employees who voted to go on strike but were volunteering to continue working don't get unemployment either, because under the law, which is not a section that is proposed to be changed by this bill, the statute determines that they're all striking employees. Now, why is that? It's because they all still have the same economic interest in the strike. The economic pressure on the employer is going to result in a settlement at some point. The economic pressure on the employees that are on strike and aren't getting benefits is going to create economic pressure that's going to force the parties together. And at some point, they will reach a collectively bargained agreement. And they all have the same interest. And that's what the statute says right now. There is no proposal to change that element of the statute when you have a single employer with two plants. Now, let's change it a little bit more to get to a defensive lockout situation. Let's say that there are two employers, and each employer has one plant. And they have agreed with the union, whether it be the UFCW, which Safeway bargains on a multi-employer basis with a lot, or some other union, they agree to multi-employer bargaining. Remember, the union goes into that, has to approve it. The employers can't say, we want to bargain on a multi-employer basis. The union has to agree up front. If the union doesn't agree up front, it's not multi-employer bargaining. But the union agrees to multi-employer bargaining, so these two companies, each of whom have one plant and have an identical contract and have agreed by the agreement to multi-employer bargain, that all of the employees at both plants are going to have the same contract, that the union will have the same contract with both employers, and that both employers will have the same contract, have thereby agreed that they, each group has thereby agreed that it has exactly the same economic interest. The employers are having an identical interest in the negotiations, and so do the 2,000 employees if there's 1,000 in each plant. Now, the difference in multi-employer bargaining is that when the employees, all 2,000 of them from both companies, vote to go on strike, the union doesn't always strike both employers. They try to use what's typically called a whipsaw tactic, where they strike one employer. They try to put more economic pressure on one employer by closing that employer down with a strike and allowing the other employer to operate. The defensive strike situation is one that allows the second employer to lock his employees out. They can't lock those employees out unless the other employer in the group has been struck and the strike has to occur. If the employers decide the union's going to strike us next week, so we better get everybody off work now or we have control over it, it's an offensive lockout and they get the benefits. If one party is struck, which requires a vote of the employees in both companies, then the other group doesn't get unemployment benefits. And that is the defensive lockout exception that this bill is trying to eliminate. Now, what effect does that have? If I'm a single employer with two stores, and they're both covered by the same contract, and the employees won't cross a picket line and, in fact, are picketing at one store and will cross the picket line and work at the second store, I'm not required to let them work in the second store, and I'm a single employer. Now, if Fred Meyer, Albertsons, and Safeway together are bargaining and they strike Safeway, Albertsons and Fred Meyer, under this revised bill, would have to let their employees work. And that's no different than if I'm a single employer and I have two stores and I'm required to let my employees work in the second store. That is not restoring a balance. What the earlier witnesses who've offered information have failed to mention to you is that the only time this situation comes into play is if the union strikes and picks a target and goes out on strike. That's the only time it happens. And all of the employees together have made that decision. And that's why the economic pressure is on them under this provision of the employment law. I would urge you very strongly to consider what the impact of this bill would do, because if you create a situation where employers have the protection of the statute if they bargain alone, and they don't have the protection of the statute in exactly the same circumstances if they bargain together, it will destroy multi-employer bargaining. I have been negotiating labor contracts on behalf of the grocery industry for nearly 30 years. Almost all of that bargaining has taken place in a multi-employer context, and every time I've been in a multi-employer context, it has been because the union agreed to it up front. We also agree to multi-union bargaining in a lot of our distribution centers with the Teamsters. The Teamsters and other unions who want to bargain on a multi-union basis can't do so unless the employer agrees. It's the same quid pro quo as the multi-employer bargaining. There are a lot of very strong reasons why parties would want to have the same contracts amongst a group of competitors. And if you eliminate this exception and you put employers who agree with the union to multiply on a multi-employer basis at a disadvantage to the position they'd be in if they were multiplying on their own, they will bargain on their own. And if they bargain on their own, that opens up a Pandora's box of a lot of different agreements and eliminates the level playing field that most industries are trying to have and which unions strive for. Now, I don't want to tell you and sit here and try and be an expert about what unions want, but I can tell you that it's not to their advantage to have major employers who normally bargain in a multi-employer group bargain on their own, because each party will go for its own best interests and the contracts will not be uniform across an industry. And this kind of provision, if adopted, will eliminate any incentive, in fact, will create a disincentive for doing multi-employer bargaining. Thank you.
Any questions of these nice people? Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So does either of your stores have stores in Washington or California?
Yes.
And is the law the same there as it is in Oregon?
The law in the other states...
Washington's the same.
I don't know. I handle Oregon, but I can tell you that we have upwards of 250 stores in Washington, and we have hundreds of stores in California.
To follow up, Mr. Chair, the testimony we had earlier from some of the other witnesses were that in Washington and Oregon and California, people in exactly the same situation did qualify for benefits.
That's not in Washington. The law is the same. In fact, we're in the middle of multi-employer with UFCW in Washington right now with Safeway and Albertsons. And if the union strikes one of those employers, the other employers will lock out, and they do not receive unemployment benefits under Washington law right now.
In California, you don't know.
I'm not directly involved with the California negotiations. I know that there has been a lot of publicity involving the 4.5-month strike that took place in California 3 years ago that involved the same employers whose representatives are sitting here today. But I can tell you that in California, this time, they're not multi-employer bargaining. What the witnesses, when they were talking about this bill, failed to comment on is the fact that the only time this exception ever comes into play is because the employee group from all the employers has voted by a majority vote to go on strike. It's not a situation where the employers lock people out in order to put economic stress on them. That would be an offensive lockout. It happens after a strike has occurred. The employees have voted to go on strike to put economic pressure on the employer group. If the union would choose to strike all of the employers in the group, they would have more economic problems of their own. But Safeway has been involved in a number of strikes where the unions have chosen to strike all of the employers. But most of the time in multi-employer bargaining, that's not the case. And that's where this exception is addressed.
And just one more question, mm-hmm. Mr. Chair. So I think that one of you testified that there would be no incentive for people to go back to work if they were qualifying for unemployment. It seems to me that people are making a lot more when they're at work than they're making, even if they were getting the maximum benefit under unemployment, and that alone would be enough of an incentive people to want to keep bargaining, get a contract, and go back to work.
Mr. Chair and Representative Rosenbaum, what I was referring to there is not that it wouldn't give them incentive to come back to work. It's that it would, what I intended to say there was that it would prolong a strike. It's the state providing assistance to prolong the strike, because if they have some economic relief, that's less incentive to come back to the bargaining table. I'm not saying that when they go on strike they don't want to be working. A strike is a horrible, awful situation for all, and we're not successful if we don't have a good relationship with our employees, and we're not successful if our employees aren't happy, and we're not successful if we don't provide them with good wages and benefits. So it's the whole point to the way the law is set up right now is it provides a balance and a reason for both sides, equal pressure, to come back to the bargaining table as quickly as possible. And when you put the economic harm on the employer because there's pickets in front of their stores and their regular workers aren't there that their customers know, and then you provide a little bit of assistance to the striking employees, it prolongs it, and it makes that a little bit uneven in terms of the pressure to bring both sides back to the bargaining table.
Just to let you know, the employees always suffer more in a strike. It's never level. The employees always suffer more. So the pressure is not equal during a strike, ever. It's always the employee, the wage worker, that suffers the most because they don't have a lot of money. I mean, and just so you know, I'm sympathetic to this bill. It's no secret. I'm sure your lobbyist told you that. that in the late 80s, I worked, and up to 1990, I worked for Morse Brothers, and we built precast concrete pieces. And all the concrete architectural panels on that the signs are hanging on, Safeway, at 100 Southeast 122nd and Sunnyside, I worked on those in the yard, and I worked on them in the site. And we shop at that Safeway because of your relationship with workers. I have never stepped foot in a Walmart. And I'll tell you, thank you. That relationship, as me as a customer, will continue as long as you continue that relationship with your workers. I just wanted to share that with you. Representative Holby, do you have something to add here?
Yeah, I just have a question. Do, in your multi-employer group, does Safeway and Fred Meyer and Albertsons, I guess, do they all negotiate with all of their employees at the same time?
Mr. Chair.
All together? I mean, do all the Safeway and Albertsons employee units bargain with your multi-employer group at once?
No, we have multiple multi-employer groups for based on when contracts expire. For example, Mr. Ball testified, and Melinda mentioned that we currently have negotiations going on in Representative Edwards' district down in Eugene. That's a multi-employer group. In a couple of months, I believe at the end of July, contracts in the Salem area expire. And at that point, we will enter negotiations in Salem. How the Salem negotiations will be structured, we don't know yet. It's the opening letters just recently came out. But we also have other areas. Safeway operates in more areas of the state than either Albertsons or Fred Meyer. We actually have 19 separate retail clerk agreements with the UFCW, and they cover different 19 different geographical operating areas, and all but two of them are in the state of Oregon. So we have 17 different areas, and the timing on those contracts differs. But the concept is the same in each area.
But notwithstanding that, you know, I'm trying to look at this bill. I'm looking, you know, because, I mean, there's a distinct difference between a lockout and a strike. And, and in your testimony, you're sort of combining those just because of their close relationship, perhaps, between your multi-employer individual employers that are scattered around the state or the different organizations. And in the definition of a lockout in our statute, is it just means any refusal by an employer to permit employees to work as a result of a dispute with such employees affecting wages, hours, and other terms or conditions of their employment. And that's a lot different than a strike. And a strike means any concerted act of employees in a lawful refusal under application of state and federal law to perform work or services for an employer. And so to me, I think there's a distinct difference there between those two actions, and they're not eligible for unemployment benefits under the strike where the employees are choosing not to work, but when the employer is taking the action and refusing to let people to work who are ready and able to go to work, I think that's what this bill simply is trying to address. And so I mean, it just seems to me that your testimony is sort of confusing those two complete different, even though they might happen in the same area, they are different actions by different employers, and I think that's what this bill is trying to address, is, you know, that it's not the, why are you punishing a group of employees that work for an employer that are ready and willing to go to work in that scenario? If you do that, it seems like they ought to be able to collect unemployment.
Mr. Chairman, if I may respond.
Please do.
In that fact situation that you describe, you're overlooking the fact that a strike, a defensive lockout, never occurs unless the employees who are going to be locked out have voted as part of the group to go on strike. They have the same vested interest as the people who don't go to work. And when an employer is struck, a single employer, all of his employees are on strike. When a single employer with two plants has his employees strike, both plants are on strike. When you have a multi-employer group of employers bargaining together, which has been agreed to in advance by the union with whom they're negotiating. You put all the employers into one group, and it's like you have a single employer. Well, with a simple example, I used one store for each of us. It would be a single employer with three plants or three stores. And they're all treated the same. The employees get treated the same. They're all going to get the same benefits and so on. They could all strike. They all, in fact, do vote to strike, but the union tells some of them to go back and be available for work. They're going to have the same economic interests and share the same benefit of whatever comes out of the strike. The employers are going to have the same contract that comes out of the strike. But the lockout in that situation is never triggered unless the employees go on strike. They have voted to withhold their services.
Mr. Chairman, may I provide an illustration for this, Representative Holby? Let's take the negotiations going on in Eugene right now. You have Albertson, Safeway, and Fred Meyer in a multi-employer bargaining agreement. Forgive me, Mr. Ball. If the union decides to strike Albertsons, say tomorrow negotiations go badly, the union decides to strike Albertsons. Those employees of Albertsons are on strike. They will not receive unemployment. As part of the multi-employer bargaining agreement, Safeway and Fred Meyer then defensively lock their employees out. Under this law, Safeway and Fred Meyer's employees will receive unemployment benefits. So I would wonder what we would tell the employees of Albertsons who have given their union authority to enter into a multi-employer bargaining agreement, have told them that they're doing this as a group, they're doing it because it will result in a better contract, it will result in a level playing field where everyone in the industry is making the same wages, but Albertsons employees, you're not going to get your unemployment while the other members of this group are going to get unemployment. They've all gone into it as a group. They've all made the decision as a group. But part of them are going to get unemployment and part of them aren't.
Representative Holy.
Well, you just gave me testimony that you're not, Safeway and Albertsons are not bargaining for the same contract at the same time.
No.
And so the Albertsons employees aren't bargaining at the same time as the Safeway, and the Albertsons employees don't want to go out on strike. They want to work, and the strike, I guess, at the Safeway, for example, is over the Safeway negotiation. So I guess I'm just did I interpret that incorrectly from what you told
me? I'm sorry. Yes, sir, you did. In the negotiations going on in Eugene right now that Melinda was referring to.
All those stores are negotiating at the same time for the same contract?
Yes. And the employees, there is a single set of proposals from the union for the employers, a single set of proposals from the employer to the union for all the stores, for all the companies that are involved in those negotiations in Eugene. The contracts cover geographical areas, so the Eugene contract covers Lane County. The Salem contracts actually cover the four counties surrounding Salem, so that's a different set of negotiations. But the concept is the same. And when there is an offer given in Eugene, it'll be given on behalf of all three of the employers. It will be an identical offer for all three, for all of the employees, regardless of whom they work for. And when the employees ratify that agreement, if they ratify it, they will be ratifying the agreement so that they will all have exactly the same terms and conditions of employment, and they all vote together. It's not a separate vote. It's a single group. That's the multi-employer structure. And if they choose to go on strike, it'll be because a majority of that entire group has voted to strike. It's not separate negotiations. It's not separate contracts with different terms. They're identical.
Well, I thought you just described to me previously that all these negotiations take on at different times in these different stores and that they aren't exactly the same.
Well, Safeway, I don't mean to argue, sir, but, for example, Safeway has 19 clerk contracts and 18 meat cutter agreements, and they don't all expire on February 17th. Two contracts expired on February 17th, the Eugene meat cutters agreement and the Eugene grocery contract. We've got three or four more contracts that expire in the Salem area, but they're negotiated at a different time, and they expire, I want to say, on like July 29th or something. Now, our Albertsons and Fred Meyer have the same contract. We negotiated Salem last time as a multi-employer group, and the contracts for the employer are identical, and they were bargained at the same time, and they all expire at the same time, and we anticipate that they'll all be negotiated at the same time again. But the Salem negotiations are separate from the Eugene negotiations. They're separate documents.
And, Mr. Chairman, Representative, think of this as geographically in terms of how these negotiations are done. It's not a statewide, so there are these disparities in terms of when these contracts are negotiated. I think that's what we need to clarify for you.
I'm going to give the last question to this panel to Representative Edwards, please. And then we're going to move along.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You talked a bit of, well, we've talked a lot about multi-employer bargaining and potential disincentive to multi-employer bargaining. Who makes that? For background information for myself, because I'm not really familiar, who makes the determination whether or not you have multi-employer bargaining? Is that a mutually agreed to between the bargaining unit and the stores in this case, or is there governing, there probably is governing law over it, but could you explain a little bit more about that?
Sure.
Yes,
yes, there is law. Under the National Labor Relations Act, which is the federal legislation that covers the relationship between employers and employees in the United States, if you are going to have multi-employer bargaining, that is a mutually agreeable arrangement, meaning the union has to agree to it before it starts. And once the commitment is made to bargain on a multi-employer basis, an employer cannot unilaterally withdraw. For example, there's a construction case from the mid-80s where a number of contractors had joined together on a multi-employer basis to negotiate with a trade union, and a strike occurred. And when the strike occurred, they struck one employer, and that employer was unable to take the financial pressure and wanted to settle. Ultimately, that employer was bound by the overall contract that the rest of the association agreed upon because that employer could not get out of negotiations with the multi-employer group unless everybody agreed that they could get out. We can't start negotiations with the union on a multi-employer basis unless the union agrees to it up front. So if the union doesn't want to bargain on a multi-employer basis, we can't do it. And, in fact, at the outset of the negotiations in your district, we contacted the union, and they asked us how we wanted to bargain, and we indicated that we wanted to bargain on a multi-employer basis, and there was some discussion about that. And the bottom line that was that the parties decided they would bargain on a multi-employer basis. If the union had said no, we wouldn't be bargaining on a multi-employer basis because legally we can't do so.
Okay. Representative Berger, do you have any questions?
No, I think my question was answered. That's what I was kind of waiting. Okay. I had to, sorry.
Because we're moving on this panel.
Yeah, got it.
Okay. Mm-hmm. But if you have anything.
No.
All right. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for your time.
My pleasure. Dan, Mr. Floyd, do you want to come on up and add to this?
You notice Mr. Oxley took off once I was up here. Leave me alone for the committee. For the record, Dan Floyd, or sorry, Chair Shaw for members of the committee. For the record, Dan Floyd representing the Northwest Grocery Association. I try to make it a rule not to read, but I have a testimony on behalf of Albertsons today. You notice that you've talked about them quite a bit, so I'll read this testimony briefly for you. On behalf of Super Value and Albertsons stores in Oregon, I share with you our strong reservations to House Bill 3339. As you may know, Super Value is the parent company to Albertsons. Super Value operates 2,400 stores, 900 in-store pharmacies, and over 120 gas stations in 49 states, employing over 200,000, including 120,000 union members. We have over 50 stores in Oregon, 55 to be exact. We are concerned House Bill 3339 will create a situation where the state is aiding unions in a strike by providing unemployment benefits to employees who are unemployed due to their choice. A possible result, some striking employees will not have unemployment while their colleagues who are part of the same strike will. In Oregon and around the nation, our industry often enters into multi-employer bargaining agreements with the unions that represent our associates. In fact, Safeway, Albertsons, and Fred Meyer are currently in the midst of negotiations with UFCW Local 555 in the Eugene area under a multi-employer bargaining agreement. The outcome of these negotiations will affect employees throughout southern and central Oregon. These multi-employer bargaining agreements approved by the National Labor Relations Act allow a level playing field where employees across industry are being paid the same wages and benefits. When employees vote to strike under a multi-employer agreement, they are aware that if they are locked out, they will not receive unemployment. Thus, a defensive lockout is not perpetuated by the employer, but by the union when it strikes as part of a multi-employer bargaining unit. If you do away with the unemployment exemption and a defensive lockout, you will create an inequitable situation. The employees of the struck employer would not receive unemployment, while the employees who were part of the defensive lockout would receive benefits. Thus, you have one group of employees on strike due to the same contract negotiations getting unemployment and one group not. I strongly encourage you to consider this bill, the effect of this bill on the bargaining system. Thank you. I know I just repeated a lot that was said before me, so I will stop.
I have one question. I heard a rumor about an amendment that's going to insert a bottle bill into this bill. Is that true? Anyway, I'm just joking.
I'm okay with talking about shopping carts right now.
Yeah, right. Okay. All right. I'm sorry. I apologize.
Support for shopping carts.
Any questions for Mr. Floyd? All right. Thank you, Dan.
Thanks.
All right, then. I have Elizabeth Kushwa and Omar Avina Trejo. Excuse me, sir. Come on up. And if you all want to kind of respond to some of the things we heard up here, I'd appreciate that. Thank you.
Hello. I'm Elizabeth Kushla. I'm representing UFCW, and my testimony did get a little bit longer after hearing everything I just heard. The first thing I'd like to do, if you please, is to respond to you, Representative Rosenbaum, your question about California. The earlier example from Longshoremen is maritime specific for California, Oregon, and Washington, and that's why that worked that way. That was the first part of your question. The second part has to do with what's happening in California. I didn't want to drop names, but Albertsons, right now UFCW in California is negotiating 21 separate negotiations with 21 separate stores, 21 separate locals, because Albertsons locked out tens of thousands of people for over 100 days. And the result of the damage of that lockout is now they will no longer collectively bargain. The result of all of that economically, and obviously with such a huge number of people having been affected, right now California Senate Bill 116 has just passed in the Senate in California, has made it through the first reading in the Assembly, and is on its way toward passage in the Assembly in California as a result of that. And that bill will do exactly what HB 3339 will do for this. So I hope that answers your questions and gives you a little bit of a context. Just very quickly, I think that this is a common sense bill. If you take the hypothetical that was previously used, in that we have multiple employers, and we've all agreed at the beginning we're not going to strike, and they strike, and we lock them out, and that's it, we're all one big happy family, we're done. If you tweak that hypothetical and say, okay, so one of those employers does something to create a problem whereby their union can exercise its historical right to strike, what you're saying is that gives the employers protection,
yes, ma'am,
because there would be no recourse, right? I mean, they get to misbehave, but you can't strike because then everybody else gets locked out. So where does the converse happen with that? That's my question. It's different than the example of one employer and several locations. They are separate employers. Separate employers do behave differently. It isn't the same. And I don't want you to be confused in that way. The idea here, I think, is commonsensical because it's involuntary. You go to work, and you're not allowed to go to work. You didn't make that decision with your employer. And while the contracts for collective bargaining are the same, they are separate contracts. those people aren't contracting with all three stores, so they can go to work at Safeway and then go to work at Fred Meyer and go to work at Albertsons. They're working at Safeway. So the idea here is not collective bargaining is a tool of ease to ensure parity for similar workers and to create an easier environment for everyone. It shouldn't be then turned around and being used as a bludgeon if one employer does something that causes their employees to strike and then locks out everybody else. This is involuntary. And what this does essentially is codify a double jeopardy. You can't go to work, but you can't get unemployment benefits. Not okay. And that just, it doesn't make sense from a common sense basis. In terms of this great economic benefit that's happening, you know, many unions have strike funds to aid workers who are able to exercise their historical rights to strike. And they can give $100 or something to the families who are struggling, because it's true, striking is painful for everybody. They are not going to be able to afford to give that money to the striking workers and then everybody else who isn't allowed to go to work through no fault of their own. And so I just want you to be able to think of the converse of what's been happening here and to realize that this is happening in other states and they're taking steps, active steps, to change it. This is common sense, and UFCW urges your support and your strong support on the floor as well of HB 3339.
Thank you. Sir, go ahead.
I'm just here on behalf. My name is Omar Avina, UFCW union representative, and I'm here on behalf of Steve Canova to turn his testimony. I just would like to take a minute to, you know, as a former grocery worker, urge you to pass this bill, because I know this strain that it takes on the workers. The employer makes it look as if, you know, they lock us out. We made that choice. We didn't make that choice. We, as employees, were willing to go to work, and it's not fair that they chose to do that just because we did it to a different employer. It's completely separate, and the things need to be fair now. So I really, you know, would like for you guys to pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for these nice people? Representative Berger.
I'm sorry, I forgot your name.
Elizabeth.
No, Elizabeth. Explain to me the sort of significant piece that the previous panel put forward was that, yeah, they're working at a different store and they aren't striking, but they voted for the strike. Is that in error? Did those people at, say, in the example, you know, Fred Meyer's being struck, but in Malta bargaining, did the Safeway folks who are presumably, you know, about to be locked out and or locked out, did they vote for the strike? Did they have a vote, and did their bargaining unit positively say, we vote to strike?
Chair Schaffler, Representative Berger, yes. That's the case. But what that is a result of can be several things. And one of it is essentially misbehavior on the part of their employer. And by choosing, you know, to be a part of a union, you know, in per penny, in per pound, in many ways. But you need to also think about the causes for the strike, the purposes for the strike. They're all not all nefarious, oh, we're going to negotiate the hell out of Safeway's reasons. They're legitimate reasons to strike.
Mr. Chair, my point is this. I nobody likes strikes. Okay.
No.
But let's go back to the keep it simple paradigm here. They have chosen to strike. They know the consequences of that strike, and they knew going into the multiple employer bargaining that this was a possibility. Nobody said along the way, oh, by the way, and if you vote to strike, you're going to be held harmless, but the rest of your union, you know, is going to be on the, or these people over working over there. So I guess no fault of their own, which is a quote from you, either they didn't understand their responsibilities, which is a union problem, Or they did. And it, and in voting to strike, I just think that they have made a strike vote, and that is a positive action. And to then say, okay, if the people who are all bargaining together, Albertsons, Safeway, everybody's bargaining on the same thing, but you're held harmless here, but you're not, although you both made the positive action to strike, I guess no fault of their own just doesn't, I'm just not sure that I buy that. I mean, I know we're looking at the same elephant from different views, but I guess this positive strike thing weighs with me.
And I do understand that concept. I guess the problem we're having here is if we were talking about three different unions negotiating with three different stores, for example, as opposed to, say, one union negotiating with three different stores, at which point what you've done is said you don't have a recourse.
Mr. Chair,
I'm not trying to argue.
But the union chose to bargain collectively with the three stores. They could have gone one store, one union.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that choice was made voluntarily, as was the strike voluntarily. I'm just not persuaded. We could argue this all day, but
it would be bad.
Is the governor of California going to sign that bill?
I would doubt it.
I'd be surprised, too. Just so I get this right, too. Albertsons, Safeway, Freddy's, the people at Albertsons aren't happy. All employees at all three stores are under the same contract bargaining agreement. They all vote to go on strike to help their brothers and sisters in Albertsons. I think if I were the lawyer, even with this legislation, I would say they all voted for a strike, so why should we deny them benefits, or why should we provide them benefits, even if they... if they do decide to lock out, they all voted. Even underneath this language, the bill's language, I think the lawyer from the other two stores would say they voted yes to go on a strike. So even if they are locked out, I'm kind of struggling myself, to be quite frankly, and I'm very sympathetic with this. I'll vote for this bill. But if I were a fancy Philadelphia lawyer, I think they could come and say, well, you know what, they all voted to go on strike. So I just want you to clarify that for me, too, somehow.
Chair Schaffler, I will do my best. I will honestly admit to you at this time that I am nobody's labor lawyer. And I will probably turn around and stare at Rick for a minute, and feel free to leap right up and tell me that I'm wrong. Yes, we've collectively bargained.
Mm-hmm.
The unions have collectively bargained. But each contract is with each company.
Oh, so all three signed. There's three contracts there, even
there's
though it's
under
one
collective bargaining. There's three contracts.
Okay.
They're the same contract.
Thank you.
In language, except for who the contract is.
So Safeway has a contract. Albertsons has a contract. Fred Meyer's has a contract. There's not one contract covering all three. Okay,
yes.
Forgive me.
It's
now it's clear to me.
Separate
Representative
contracts.
Holder. And then we're going to move on. We really got to get going.
Well, I just wanted to ask a question in this multi-employer group where you do have three different contracts. Is it not possible that one of your employers violates the terms of the contract or does something that doesn't negotiate in good faith or something like that where the other employers do, and so you have one of those actors that is in the multi-employer group that's not performing up to the contract and the other two are, so wouldn't it in that scenario, wouldn't that be able to happen?
Chair Schaffler, Representative Holley, yes, that's what I was trying to articulate, although probably poorly earlier.
Well, I don't know if I did it any better, but given that scenario, the union may vote to strike the one employer who they're having trouble with as far as the terms of negotiating or with the terms of the contract itself, and really have no reason to strike the other employers because they have separate contracts and they haven't done anything against the contracts. So it doesn't make sense to me that they could lock out the entire industry in this multi-employer group in that scenario. And that's, I guess, my point, that the lockout is different because you're than a strike when you're dealing with different employers that have different contracts.
One brief response and then we're moving on.
Chair Schaffler, Representative Holden, bingo.
That's good enough. Thank you very much. Mr. Byerly, you want to come up and add anything to this? in about 25 seconds.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You're very kind. Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Can you talk as fast as Obi can?
No.
Okay. Go ahead, sir. Forgive me.
Assistant where was I? Tom Byerly, Assistant Director for the Employment Department. I do unemployment insurance. I really don't have anything to add. I think the prior testimony is pretty accurate. Mr. Chair, I'm inclined to agree with you that in looking through the statute, even if we take the lockout language out, by the way, we are neutral. We'll do whatever you guys want. If we take the language out, I think if a class of workers are going to benefit from the labor dispute, there still may be an argument that they wouldn't receive their unemployment insurance. So I think it's an interesting concept, frankly. But I'm here to answer the questions you guys might have and how the law currently works or would work.
Questions? Any questions?
No.
Thank you very much.
Thank you
very much. The chair requests that we close the, what are we in?
Public
hearing on 3339 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2943. You want to give us a...
Yes, Madam Chair, committee members. House Bill 2943 is a Business and Labor Committee bill. It requires that a director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services to adopt rules regarding the standards of conduct for providers of independent medical examinations and workers' compensation claims if the appropriate health professional regulatory board does not adopt standards. There's no revenue impact. I've not seen a fiscal impact on this. There is a -1 amendment from the Independent Medical Examination Association, which changes the guidelines of conduct from the American Board of Independent Medical Examiners to the Independent Medical Examination Association. It also removes the date of reference that is it's currently in the bill in regards to the date of the American Board's guidelines of conduct, and it also adds an emergency clause effective on passage.
Thank you. Questions, staff? No. Hasina Squires and John Schultz. Yeah. Why don't you guys come up together and tell us what we need to know?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Hasina Squires on behalf of the Independent Medical Examination Association of Oregon. We're going to try to make this very quick, brief, and concise. There does not appear to be any opposition to this bill. This bill is necessary as a result of Senate Bill 311 from last legislative session that the legislature passed that regulated independent medical examination providers. Workers' Comp Department maintains a list of providers who are certified to conduct IMEs in the state of Oregon. One of the provisions of Senate Bill 311 contained causes or the ability for WCD to remove providers.
WCD.
Workers' Comp Division, excuse me. To allow John, the director actually, to remove certified independent medical exam providers from the list. And the criteria, what one of the criteria was for violating code of conduct, standards in a code of conduct. And the code of conduct that applies is if you're a chiropractor or if you're a physician, it would be your board's code of conduct. If they have not adopted a code of conduct, then the default code of conduct is the American Board of Independent Medical Exam code of conduct.
Thank you.
It's a national organization. We didn't think there'd be a problem with that. Their code of conduct is quite nice. However, once WCD started talking to ABIME, it became ABIME, which is the American Board of Independent Medical Examination. They indicated that they would like physicians in Oregon to go through their training program and possibly pay a fee for the use of that code.
Of course.
Astoundingly enough, we were quite shocked to hear that and are very supportive of allowing John to disqualify providers off of the list for violating a code, but now we need to have a different code. So what this bill does is delete the ABIME code of conduct and inserts the IMEA code of conduct, which I've attached for your reference, and puts an emergency clause on it. WCD has indicated that their current sort of contract with ABIME to allow us to use that will expire on May 2nd, so that's why the emergency clause is necessary.
Sure.
Go ahead, John.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm John Schiltz. I'm the administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, which is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Thank you for allowing me to testify today. Hasina has really covered the bill, and I know you've got a busy schedule, so I'm going to be very brief. You have my written testimony. Attached to my written testimony are the Independent Medical Examination Association's guidelines of conduct. That would replace the American Board of Independent Medical Examiners guidelines of conduct. Frankly, these new guidelines are very clear. They're very enforceable. In my opinion, they are more effective than the old guidelines. The Workers' Compensation Management Labor Advisory Committee supported this bill and the Dash 1 amendments. I wanted to mention that there's an identical bill pending in the Senate, Senate Bill 836. This bill is ahead of Senate Bill 836, but I just wanted to mention that in case those two come up at any point. And just wanted to mention also there is no fiscal impact that we're aware of on this bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Any questions for these nice people? Does anybody else have any concerns about this bill today? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Just open up a public hearing, right?
Yeah.
I'm going to close public hearing on House Bill 2943, and I'm going to work session on House Bill 2943. Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2943.
Representative Rosenbaum moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2943. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So moved. Representative Rosenbaum,
yes,
please.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2943 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Rosenbaum moves House Bill 2943 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Kristen, please.
Aye.
Representative
Berger.
Aye.
Vice Chair Escobell. Excuse.
Aye.
Smith. Excuse.
Representative Rosenbaum. Aye.
Aye. Do we need to carry this, do you think? Or can we put this on a consent calendar?
I always want things carried.
Well, then, would you elect to volunteer to carry it?
I will carry it. God bless you. That's why I ended up carrying so many things, because I just hate it when people...
That's fine, Representative. You don't have to carry it. Want me to carry it?
I'll carry it.
God bless you. You're a fine American. All right. I'm going to close work session on House Bill 2943 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3353.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 3353 is sponsored by the Committee on Consumer Protection at the request of the Oregon Landscape Contractors Association. It eliminates the pesticide applicator licensing exemption that's currently in statute for persons that are engaged in the maintenance of lawns, shrubs, or gardens. It allows the fee for the pesticide trainee certificate to be less than the fee for the pesticide applicator license. It also eliminates the State Department of Agriculture's authority to establish maximum work period or training periods for a pesticide trainee. And you have a Dash 1 amendment in front of you from the association, which deletes the work periods for the trainee.
Thank you. I have Mr. Bill Crossing. John, what's your last name?
Galista.
Galista. Thank you. Mr. Galista. Go right ahead, gentlemen.
Okay. Chair Schaffler and committee, thank you for your time. I appreciate it. My name is John Galista. I own Professional Grounds Management. We're a landscape contracting company in the Portland metro area. I'm past president of the state association, and I currently serve as the legislative chair. On behalf of Olka's request, I request your support for this bill. It addresses several pesticide-related issues which concern the landscape contractors. The association supports the Control Act and Department of Agriculture's efforts to regulate the formulation, distribution, storage, transportation, and application use of pesticides. Many landscape contractors are licensed as pesticide operators, as I am, and take the proper precautions when applying pesticides. As licensed operators, we've completed training and/or testing and demonstrated educational qualifications to hold our license, and we have demonstrated also that we've met the liability insurance requirements as put forth by the Department of Ag. We're required to demonstrate knowledge of our characteristics of pesticide use and the applications to crops, plants, and practices, and the precautions taken in concern with the applications. As licensees, we must maintain liability insurance to keep our license, and we have to have CE courses and retest or keep our license credits up to date every 5 years. Currently, there is a statutory exemption for persons who do not advertise or publicly hold themselves as being landscape professionals. They can apply without advertising that they do pesticide applications on small homes, gardens, and shrub beds. HB 3353 would eliminate that exemption and require everyone who meets the definition of a pesticide operator to be licensed as an operator. So we believe that this will address the public health and safety risks associated with the commercial applications, whether to residential lawns and shrubs, commercial properties, or public entities. Let's see. Sections 1, 5, and 6 of this bill would accomplish that objective. The other issues that we're trying to address with this legislation is making the trainee's license more economical and viable for pesticide operators so we can enhance the licensure of our employees. Right now, the state currently requires that a trainee's license be the same as an applicator's license, yet the trainee does not have the same level of authorization. They've got to be on site with a licensed applicator. But they're paying the same price for that license, and it can only renew itself within. It's a one-year license, and they can only renew it once. We are hoping that with the pass of this bill, that the recertification or the relicensure would be on an ongoing basis. Is that correct?
That's correct. For the record, my name is Bill Cross, and I'm an advocate for the Oregon Landscape Contractors Association. And what we've approached the Oregon Department of Agriculture was how we could make the trainee renewed on an ongoing basis because of the limitation of one-year renewal. And a lot of the employees no longer are seasonal, temporary. We have ongoing employees that are out there that would be eligible to renew but aren't able to right now under the rules. We thought we could address that by statute. So you'll see that there was an amendment made to the bill in sections 3 and 4 to change some language there. We found out since that the Department of Agriculture can do it by rule, they're willing to entertain a petition for a rule change and to go through the rulemaking process as opposed to requiring that fix in the legislative, in the statute itself. So we do have a -1 amendment that we've offered in conjunction with the Department of Agriculture to eliminate that attempt to do something statutorily, which we can do actually through the rulemaking process. But the one change that John mentioned is the fee language in the bill would allow then the department, again, by rule, to look at reducing the fee maybe for the renewing licenses once they pass the exam and the training on a renewal basis. That fee could perhaps be lowered from what it is now, and the statute doesn't allow them to do that.
All right, thanks, Bill. Any questions, ladies and gentlemen? Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there a difference between, with regards to state law, pesticides and herbicides, or is everything just called a pesticide?
Everything's called a pesticide. Kill a vegetative would be an herbicide. To kill a little bug would be an insecticide.
Okay. But it all falls under the broad definition.
Correct.
Or label as pesticide.
Correct.
Okay.
Thank you. Any more? Representative Holby.
Do you know what the fee would be for the landscapers to get this kind of a applicator license for pesticides?
A trainee's license.
Or a trainee license, yeah.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, I believe the fee is $50 for the applicator's license as well as the trainee's license.
Okay, thanks.
Any further questions? All right, thanks, guys.
Thank you.
I'd like to call Terry Witt, Lisa Hansen, and Chris Kirby, please. Go ahead.
Almost good evening, Mr. Chair. Terry Witt, Executive Director of Oregonians for Food and Shelter. Passing out some testimony that's short, and I'll make it even shorter by just jumping to the last paragraph. We fully support this bill and applaud the Oregon Landscape Contractors Association for taking this step. We think it's a very important step in the direction of increasing professionalism in applications that take place in the public. And for even on the record, I would like to say that perhaps in years to come, we can bring forth a bill that would require janitors and maintenance people to have the same licensure to ensure that they have the same kind of professionalism. So we fully support this bill. And just to clarify, there's a kind of a humorous way to remember what a pesticide is. I've heard it said that pesticides include all of the acides, like insecticide, herbicide, fungicide, rodenticide. So pesticides include all of the acides other than suicide and homicide.
And Mr. Witt, I just want to, well, it's in my mind, you know, you're exactly right. We're going to make sure there's educated, licensed, regulated professionals applying these chemicals in our environment. And I'm rather disappointed that there aren't some more people in here to come here and support this bill, because their life's made better because of the use of a lot of these chemicals, to be quite frank with you. And I'm disappointed they're not here, and you and I know exactly who I'm talking about. Yes. All right, go ahead. Thank you very much.
Members of the committee, I'm Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director with the Oregon Department of Agriculture, and with me is Chris Kirby, who's the administrator of our Pesticides Division. I can make this really short and then just open it up for questions if you have questions about our program. We have the responsibility for enforcing the state pesticide law. We support removing the exemption for landscapers and really believe this, again, provides the basis of what our program is based on in licensing, is education and licensing to assure safe and effective use of pesticides so it protects human health and the environment.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Sure.
For the record, my name is Chris Kirby. As Deputy Director Hansen indicated, I'm the administrator of the Pesticides Division. I'm here to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Any questions of this panel?
No question.
Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I'm a homeowner, this wouldn't affect my ability to put fertilizer or a pesticide of some sort on my own lawn or shrubs, or correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, that is correct. This pertains to businesses, even though they be one-person businesses that apply pesticides on the property of others. It would not impact persons making applications on their own property.
Okay. Follow-up.
Representative, follow-up.
And then, so the follow-up to that is if a homeowner wants to hire somebody, high school labor, come over, cut my yard, and could you spray the roadies with whatever you spray roadies with? Would this apply to that or not? Or
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, I believe that this would apply to this in that it removes an existing exemption and says that if your business is doing this sort of work, including applying pesticides, then you are subject to operator licensing.
Okay. Right.
Representative Berger.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I got to put it on the record, and I hire yard work done precisely for this kind of reason, that I would not trust my husband with. In fact, I don't trust him with a sprayer for this very reason, and I'm happy to say that I think it's a good idea that people who do this have better training and better understanding of what they're doing than my husband does.
Well, Representative, I share your concern. I think it's real important for the consumer to read all directions carefully and follow them to the letter, and then we don't have any problem with this stuff. Representative Holby.
Just to make sure I know who you're talking about, I do support this bill, and that's why my committee sponsored this bill, because we truly appreciate people using pesticides safely and professionally, and I think this is a great bill.
And Representative, I'm sure every member on this committee is eternally grateful for the great wisdom coming out of your committee. Thank you very much for bringing this bill forward. Any more questions for these nice people? All right. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3353. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3353. Representative Volpe.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3353.
Representative Holby. Representative Holby moves the Dash 1s into House Bill 3353. Is there discussion or objection? Seeing none, so moved. Representative Holby.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3353 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Holby moves House Bill 3353 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Kristen, please.
Aye.
Aye.
Excused.
Aye.
Excused.
Aye.
Aye. Representative Holby, would you like to carry this bill on the floor?
I would be honored to carry this bill.
I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3353. I'm going to open a hearing on House Bill 3354.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3354, it was also brought to you by the Committee on Consumer Protection at the request of the Oregon Landscape Contractors Association, and changes parameters for electrical installations that can be made by a landscaping business to allow the installations of irrigation control wiring and outdoor landscape lighting, which involves a 30-volt system that does not exceed 750-volt amperes. You have a Dash 1 amendment from the association, which clarifies that the lamp business can install a Class 1 or Class 2 system that does not exceed 30 volts and 750 volt amperes.
Thank you. Bill, you want to come back up? Bill Cross and John Stone, please. Just go right into it, guys.
Chair Shaw for the committee, thank you for taking the time for us this afternoon. My name is John Stone. I own a company called J.P. Stone Contractors, does landscape construction work primarily in the Portland area. I also am the current president of the Oregon Landscape Contractors Association, and we request your support for HB 3354. The legislation changes the parameters for electrical installations that landscape contractors can make. Currently, there's an exemption for limited energy electrical activity involving the installation of landscape irrigation control wiring and outdoor landscape lighting by landscape contractors. Currently, we can install up to 15-volt we'll call them appliances at this point. Industry technology has changed over the years, and most of the appliances involved are in excess of that. The irrigation valves and controllers operate on 24-volt, almost all of them. Low-voltage lighting transformers range from 12 to 22 volts. The National Electrical Code has recognized these changes, but because these products exceed what's allowed by the state's current exemption, ALCA requests your support in modifying the statutory restrictions. We just want to bring the Oregon statute into conformance with the National Electrical Code. We've worked with the Building Codes Division and the National Electrical Contractors Association in the development of 3354 to ensure that the changes to the current exemption allow a level of activity that is commensurate with the common products and the design demands of the landscape industry, balanced with safety considerations. There's a Dash 1 amendment to the bill that was developed in concert with the National Electrical Contractors Association to modify the original language somewhat and ensures that it's done by licensed landscape contractors. Passage of HB 3354 will help enhance the ability of the landscape contractors to provide common low-voltage installations to their customers with appropriate safety limitations that have served as the basis of the state's electrical laws. We urge your support.
Thank you. Bill, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Bill Cross, and I'm here representing the Oregon Landscape Contractors Association. The only thing I wanted to add was that the lobbyist for NECA was not able to be here, but we did work with them on the language development, and they're comfortable with the Dash 1 amendments.
All right, any questions? Representative Berger.
Yeah, you answered one of the questions. Have you talked to the electrical folks? The other question I have is that the language in here says landscape irrigation control wiring. Would that include whatever it is that you wire in that makes those little
valves,
fountain things that are installed in landscaping, or does an electrician have to do that? Are they bigger than this? Do you know, you don't have to talk about
it doesn't include the pumps that operate the water features.
And that's variable. We can plug in things there, but it doesn't really affect that. It's only essentially the low voltage portion of our work, which is the valves that operate the irrigation systems and the low voltage lighting.
Okay. And just for me to clarify, the majority of residential irrigation systems are plug in.
The clock is plugged in,
yeah.
And then it goes through a transformer,
right,
converting it to 24
yeah.
volts.
Right. Okay, good. Any further questions? All right, thanks, guys.
Thank you for your
time.
Thank
you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3354 and open a work session on House Bill 3354.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendments to House Bill 3354.
Representative Holey moves dash one amendments to House Bill 3354. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so moved. Representative Holey?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3354 as amended to the floor with a due pass
recommendation. Representative Holey moves House Bill 3354 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any questions? Any discussion? Question? Discussion? Seeing none. Kristen, please.
Aye.
Aye. Excuse?
Aye.
Excuse?
Aye.
Aye. All right. I guess I'll carry this one on forward. All right, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3354. Anything for the good of the order? All right, Ms. Manager.